Blog Talk Radio.
United for take two, and I'm joined by Jamie DeVal. This is Jerry Dennis. Welcome back to the show. We appreciate you listening in.
Hey, buddy.
Jamie, are you there?
I'm here, man.
Okay.
Guess what I'm doing?
I can't imagine. What?
I am attempting to upload our interview with Mr. Carter.
Okay, awesome. Okay, we want to thank everyone for sticking around. We see a lot of you in the chat room, and we appreciate it. And Jason O'Brien, because he's all sorts of McMillan and wife, could hear the opening music. So he's the man. Let's give that guy a gold star and send him to the front of the class.
Awesome. Awesome. What I'm doing right now is I am sending a request to our guest that we have booked tonight to go ahead and call in. And we'll conduct his interview, and that'll give us a chance to upload our Chris Carter interview. How does that sound?
That sounds pretty good to me. Do you, speaking, I'm going to go ahead and exit out of the Yahoo, though, on
okay.
My end. And, okay, and we are back, and we want to thank all of you for sticking around. We do appreciate it. We really do. And Jamie is trying to, we're going to do this right. We're going to get this interview for you because we all want to hear it. And we're all very curious what Mr. Carter has been up to in the last decade since the X-Files ended. I mean that. As a fan, I'm dead serious. And Joel's back, so that's good. That's good. I'm glad Joel and Jason O'Brien. Scuba Kitty, how are you? We're happy to see you. I feel like Han Solo in Star Wars, you know, talking to that comic, you know, just like endlessly.
All exactly. Right. Now, buddy, let me know when our guest number arrives on the
okay.
the show. And
what area
meantime,
code should I be looking for?
It's Skype, so it could be anything. In the meantime, we're trying to submit. sorry,
Skype.
I really narrowed it down there for you today.
We'll show up on my switchboard though.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. So, and you haven't worked the switchboard in a while. This is like
this is like, you know, it's like the first day of school all over again.
Yeah.
Oh my God! And look, so glad that Jason O'Brien is laughing in the chat room,
right.
And everyone. We appreciate everyone holding down the fort for us in the chat room, especially our very good friend the Rub, who is probably one of the best critics out there, best writers out there. So, be sure to read his reviews over at the Film Fanatic and Geeks of Doom and Film Arcade, because he's the man,
right.
And we love
right.
him.
Isn't what's that Shakespeare line from? There's the Rub. That's from. Is that Hamlet?
Oh God, you know, that's a good question.
I'm stumping
to be
you already.
Or not to be, that is
that's,
the question.
Yeah, that's Hamlet. That's Hamlet. Let's see. Let's see what else I can come up with. Now is the winter of our discontent. Made glorious summer by the son of York, and all the clouds allowed upon his house in the deep bosom of the ocean buried. What's that from?
Oh, I don't know which one that's from, but that's beautiful. What is that? I like the ones from The Merchant of Venice.
That's Richard III.
Richard III. Do you ever see that one with Ian McKellen, Richard III?
Oh, beautiful. Brilliant. Brilliant.
Yeah, that's an awesome movie. I love
he
that
changes
movie.
Location to, like, Nazi Germany or
that's,
something.
That's the perfect way to do that. That was incredible.
Oh, it's brilliant. Brilliant makeover.
Oh, look, we got old Jason's there making Jamie doing Shakespeare. I mean, I tell you, wow. All right,
I studied my Shakespeare in school.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I think he's making fun of you, man. I think he's
yeah, he's just envious.
He's jealous.
That's right. That's right. Okay, so we're waiting our first guest to call, and we're waiting our second guest to upload. So we're multitasking here.
We are. Christy is from BTR Support is asking for you.
Okay.
In the chat room.
Okay. Then let me get on that.
Okay.
I'll get in the chat.
Okay. Hi, Barinka. How are you? It's very good. She's been with us for a long time. She's great.
So yeah, absolutely. She's one of our most loyal fans, and we
mm-hmm.
appreciate her very much. Now, Jerry, the Hancock. That's the only release this weekend, isn't it?
That is the only release. But I do have to tell you something. There's another movie that comes out, the American Girl movie with Abigail Breslin. Now
right.
that opened in New York, I think last week, and my brother took his daughter to see that at the Ziegfeld.
Right.
You're not going to believe how much they're charging for tickets.
For the Ziegfeld?
$20.
Ooh.
And it wasn't, and when my brother asked, you know, is this for a charity or something? It's like, no, we're charging 20. No, we're charging 20. You know, I thought maybe it was going to go to the flood victims in the Midwest or something, maybe, or just some kind of charity. No, we're just doing this because it's not playing that many theaters, and we know we can get away with it, pretty much was the answer the guy gave. My brother being the good father, and he is, of course, paid for the tickets. But isn't that outrageous? $20?
Yeah.
I mean, that's just crazy.
Yeah, that is. Then, you know, that's going to be par for the course pretty soon.
Mm-hmm. I think so. All right.
It's terrible. It's terrible. But, it's honestly true. Everything that our previous guests have attested to, it really does have to be an event picture to warrant a $20 price tag.
You need to have state-of-the-art technology. I think you have to have, I mean, now the Ziegfeld, I've seen many films. There's a very nice theater, but American Kit Kenridge, American Girl movie? Nah. $20? No. That's got to be some incredible American Girl movie for $20. I'm sorry. That's a lot of money. That's a lot of change in this day and age.
Yeah, and plus, you know, it's when you have a family, and I sympathize with this, and some movie makers that we've talked to do too.
Mm-hmm.
It's you got to take out a second mortgage on your house to go to the movies,
at
night.
Well, like just all right, think of your family of like four, and it's not even. Let's forget the $20. Let's just go with the $10. It's $40 for the movie, and then you want to get popcorn and soda. You're looking at like another like $25-$30. I mean, you're looking at close to like, either depending on the size of the family, like $100 altogether. That's a lot.
Right.
I mean, it's really outrageous.
Yeah. That's why I I'm a movie geek, but I only go out to the movies to spend money on something that I absolutely want to see now. I mean, that's just how it is. But the fortunate thing is I feel that, and this is a sad thing actually, that so many movies out there carbon copies of one another,
mm-hmm.
and that I've already seen them before without actually having to sit down and watch them.
I just go to play the video games in the arcade. All right,
that's
not
terrible.
True.
That's terrible because this is coming from two people that love movies.
I was joking. I actually do. I still do because it isn't that bad, but I have to tell you, if it comes to $20, I mean, and let's not forget the cost of gas, too. You got to take that into consideration now. The last year or so, I mean, there's a lot of things to take into consideration. It's just very expensive. And it'd be very curious to see how all this pans out in the next couple of months.
Yeah. It will be. Okay, I think our first guest is on the line. Our second guest is uploading, so everybody keep your fingers crossed that this uploading works. It looks like it is, actually.
Yeah.
So look at that. Man, everything's coming together. You see, we just have to regroup, reassemble, and we're back better than ever.
Okay.
What an unbeatable team, everyone
out
there.
Are you also on the switchboard? Are you also?
Yeah, I'm keeping an eye on it, too, but I'll let you control it.
Okay.
But thank you so much, everyone out there, for joining us tonight. And we're ready for our first guest. Actually, I'll unmute our first guest when I bring him on, Jerry, if you don't mind.
Okay, that's fine, yeah.
Okay, our first guest. This is really exciting, a great book we want to talk about tonight. Tony Lavelle is the co-author of a new book titled Producing with Passion, Making Films That Can Change the World. With over 30 years' experience as a writer in the fields of technology and filmmaking, Mr. Lavelle has crafted a book that inspires every bit as much as it educates. from choosing a documentary subject to securing a place in the market. This step-by-step book is, in the words of Marcia Kinder, the professor of critical studies at USC School of Cinematic Arts, the handbook for any filmmaker who wants to make a documentary personal. That's not exactly what her quote was. The handbook for any filmmaker who is thinking about producing a personal documentary. My handwriting's so bad I can't even read my typing. It's terrible. But this is a very exciting guest, and we welcome on the show tonight Mr. Tony Lavelle. Let me see if I can bring him up here. Mr. Lavelle, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Jamie.
Thank you so much for being with us tonight. I'm sorry for all the difficulties this evening, but the important thing is we have you now. That's great.
we're very grateful. Thank you.
I'm impressed at your team. I mean, I have no idea what went on, but I just envision elbows and people waving cables and yelling.
I know. You know, technology is the greatest when it works for you, but there's nothing more miserable than when it doesn't work for you. But that's where we are today in this state of the world. So I loved your book, and actually your book, it had me on its title, Producing with Passion, Making Films That Change the World, because we talk about this a lot on the show. I honestly believe that film has the power to change and transform lives as it has our lives. And I was wondering about your film background. Tell me a little bit about how you came into the film medium.
Well, I actually came into film rather late. I was worked as a writer, and I've been a writer since I can remember. I mean, when I was, 7 years old, I was sitting around writing for an hour a day. And I used to go to a cafe in San Jose and talk about film all day with my friends. And one day a woman walked up to me, and she worked there, and she said, "Would you take a look at my script?" And I said, "Well, gosh, okay." And At the time, I was reading a lot of scripts. At the time, I think I was reading the script of Blade Runner, and just for my own enjoyment. And I read her script, and it was awful. And I didn't quite know what to say, and it was handwritten, and she obviously had a lot of work on it. So I said, "Well, you know, this you're writing about something you don't really know about. How it went? What's your life? What's your background?" And she started to tell me, and she had this lovely story to tell, and interesting characters in her own life. So I said, "Well, why don't you take a class at the local community college in script writing?" And she said, "Well, gosh, I haven't. I never graduated from high school." So I said, "I'll tell you what. I'll go with you." So we both signed up. And during the course of the thing, I wrote a script, and I got a standing ovation for this little student film script, and I was hooked. I was hooked. So I spent a lot of time going to script writing classes. I came up with a script for my student film and couldn't find anybody to produce it because everybody had to write their own script. So I basically set out to learn how to make movies, and that's at the time I was shooting with 16mm, and that's essentially how I got involved in all this. I went to a seminar where Dorothy Fadiman, my co-author, was presenting.
Fadiman, yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Dorothy Fadiman. And by then I had talked to a number of filmmakers, both at school and outside of school, and I'd watched people make films, and she, among all the people I talked to, had the ability to get a film finished, to get it into distribution, and to keep it there. And so a couple of years after that, I had finished up a contract in my writing business, and I called her and I said, "Look, I've got some free time. I'd like to work for your company." And so we went back and forth, and she decided to take me on as an intern. And most of her interns are beautiful 24-year-old women. So
so you're in heaven.
I'm in heaven. My wife, I didn't tell my wife any of this, and I'm hoping she's not going to listen to me.
Right.
But that's
a real kind of, it had to have been a real kind of formative relationship. I mean, you attended her seminar, and she was obviously someone that was doing it right, and so you guys eventually ended up collaborating together on this book, Producing with Passion.
Exactly.
Yeah, before this, had you given any thought to film, and had there been any films in your life that meant a lot to you?
You know, the films that were in my life were things like Tender Mercies. I mean, I must have watched it about 20 times. I liked the Blade Runner was one of my favorites. Casablanca, Maltese Falcon, Star Wars, of course, and the first Godfather film. I just have kind of a, I don't have a real eclectic, you know, a real focused view at that. That's the, those are the ones that really appealed to me. And then,
no, yeah. I've never heard anyone mention, Tender Mercies before. And, it's very encouraging that you do that, because that's one of those films that I always come back to time and time again. First of all, because of Duvall. I mean, what a remarkable performance that is. But, you know, you never hear that mentioned, and it needs to be mentioned a lot more.
It's a stunning performance, and I think Horton Foote wrote the script. Right off the top of my head. And it's a stunning performance, and the thing I love about it is, and of course Manhattan, the thing I love about it is that basically it struck me as absolutely real. And the character of Max Sledge, I mean, I think there's one line in there, you know, didn't you used to be Max Sledge? And it's, yes, ma'am, I think I was, or something like that.
Yeah.
It was just beautiful. And
that's a powerful writer, too. I'm sorry, that's a powerful writer, too, because Horton Foote, most of it is what he doesn't write. I mean, that's a pretty sparse screenplay, and it's a definite lesson of less is more when it comes to that kind of thing.
Absolutely. That's actually my belief, too, is that if you can go through, when I finished, for example, producing with passion, when I finished the first draft of it, I went in and I was really proud. I showed it to Dorothy, and she looked at it, and it was 88,000 words, and she said, well, the contract calls for 60,000, and I said, oh, gosh.
There was that passion coming out.
So we had to sit down and cut out things. And even in a nonfiction book, you have to go through and say, you know, what can you take out? What's redundant? What's extra? And you're absolutely right. And that's I found that actually taking things out and paring things down is much harder than putting things in.
I think so, and a lot of people mistake it as there's a difference between theater and film, and film is a visual medium, so however you can express it visually without having to verbalize it, it works best for film, I think. It seems to be, though, reading your book, and there's so much great information in the book, and it's so inspiring to read, but it seems like the best time right now to be in a documentary filmmaker. Does it seem like kind of a renaissance has occurred in documentaries?
Oh, I think definitely. Absolutely. I think that documentaries are really coming into their own. I mean, there's some things that when you were talking to Brian De Palma, you were talking about Redacted, and you were talking about the films that are coming out of Iraq. So I did a quick search on that and started looking at the films that are coming out of Iraq. And basically everything that's coming out right now is coming out because somebody got a cheap video camera. They were able to take it someplace where they'd never ordinarily be able to take a camera and get this footage. There's that. There's Ken Burns in the Civil War series, Fahrenheit 9/11, things like Capturing the Freedmans. Which I haven't seen, by the way. Everybody's telling me I should see
Remarkable.
It.
You should see it.
Yeah.
Blown away by it, and apparently after Fahrenheit 9/11 came out was when documentaries really started to be looked at as something that actually can make money. They can actually get into distribution, get commercial and make money. And the thing that I find is that when I was working on this book, I frankly had never really looked at documentaries seriously before, and so I went back and started looking at as many documentaries as I could, and kind of watching things from the 20s and 30s, and just blown away by the imagery that people were using and the storytelling that they were using. I mean, it was just fantastic. And things like Berlin Symphony of the City, and of course... Vertov, cameraman. My mind's going somewhere else.
Right.
And some of the movies that were made, like The River, that were made during the Depression. And mm-hmm. basically, the documentary seemed to have been shunted off into this kind of corner in which, and I think a lot of it came because they got trapped in kind of a didactic thing where they're saying, this is the subject, this is what we're going to talk about, and a kind of voice of God narrator. And then it's when you get to Michael Moore on one of the first documentaries I saw, I mean, years and years ago, that really opened my eyes to the whole possibility of documentaries was Roger and Me.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember sitting in a theater, and I was the only person in the theater, and I watched this movie twice. And it was just amazing because here's a guy who was out there telling a story, and he was telling a story that was real, and it was about real people, and it was about things that I'd seen happen, and nobody else was talking about it.
Right. Right. You know, any chance I have to talk about a great new documentary, I snatch it up. We just spoke with the director of Dear Zachary on the last show, and that's a remarkable documentary. And I just find that there's nothing more dramatic than and involving than the story of, you know, somebody that could live right around the street from you. You know, to go into the lives of these people and their culture, and you know, in all parts of the world, it's just amazing format to do that. But when you break down how to go about making a documentary, the first step is essentially choosing your subject. And what kind of things should you consider when you're choosing a subject?
Oh, something that makes you passionate. I mean, something about which you're passionate, because there is the temptation that I see in new filmmakers and filmmakers classes and people that talk to me about making movies is that, and I see it in myself too when I look at a subject for a documentary or a subject for a book, there's always this temptation to make something that's trendy or fashionable or that you can go to your friends and say, hey, well, I'm making this and everybody's interested in it. And invariably those ideas don't come from within. So it has to be something about which you're passionate, something you think about all the time, something that's on your mind all the time, or something that makes you angry, or something you look at it, you know, you hear a phrase or somebody says something and you just get chills running down your back.
Right.
And those are the indicators that you're onto something that you may be able to make a documentary about. Because if it captures your interest as a filmmaker, if it really turns you on, then there's a good chance that it's going to turn the audience on.
Mm-hmm. I'm also curious about how you go about when you go about making a documentary. You know, I'm sure that you have a plan or a goal in mind, but isn't the trick?
Mm-hmm.
And I think you say this in your book: the trick is to kind of let the project take you where it wants to go at the same time.
You know, that's a really good question, because there's a style of filmmaking, and Dorothy actually uses it, in which you kind of get the camera and you go out and start shooting and you come back and look at what you've got and then you analyze it and pick out the scenes that, excuse me, you pick out the scenes that really turn you on, that really get you going, because you'll go through your scenes, and I know you've done this too, and you start logging your footage, and you come up and say, you know, no, pow. Mm-hmm. And then there's this one scene, there's one interview, or there's one spot in an interview, or there's one somebody doing something, and it's just utterly captivating. Pull those out and start lining those up, and that will give you, say, well, gee, I hadn't thought of that, and you go down that path. And that's shooting without a script. And I just talked to somebody about doing an article about that very subject. And I worked with Dorothy for a long time before I realized that that's really what she was doing. Because what I do is I looked at exactly how she did this and how she was successful, and tried not to impose any of my preconceptions on what she was doing, because everything I'd learned in all the writing classes I'd taken, all the production classes I'd taken, was never, never, never do that. Never just pick up a camera and go out and start shooting.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that I think made her different is, or makes her different, is the fact that she's so obsessed once she gets on something that she's passionate about, she's willing to keep going until she gets it right.
Yeah.
And she's very intuitive about what she sees. And a danger in doing it that way is that you end up wasting an awful lot of time. So she and I talked about this for a long time, and we finally recommended in the book that sit down, and that's the other thing that she kind of, she was doing, but she didn't mention, and I didn't realize it until I watched her for a long time. She will get passionate about a subject, like she's doing a film right now about voting rights, and she went out to be a poll watcher in the U.S. presidential elections in 2004, and she got completely captivated by what she saw and enraged at what she saw as injustices and people being turned away from the polls and the exit polls not matching, and that turned into a film called Stealing America. And I told her I would plug that for her, and I'll do it right now. It's opening August 1 at the Quad Theater in New York City in the Village, 34 West 13th Street, Greenwich Village. It runs for a
beautiful.
Week. There you go. There
Stealing
you go, Dorothy.
Stealing America is the name of it?
Stealing America, Vote by Vote. And,
oh, wow.
She's working with Mitch Block right now, and they are going through the process of turning it into a film. And doing a theatrical release. And I'm hoping to talk to her after this interview and say, you know, you really should call these Movie Geeks folks.
Absolutely.
And,
we would welcome anyone with a passion for filmmaking. We're on their side. So, and it couldn't be more of a timely subject, too.
It's a timely subject. But when she went out to do that, she shot some footage that night. I mean, when I say she shot, she took a cameraman along with her. And shot some footage that night and looked at it and didn't really have a plan. But then, after looking at the initial footage, and this is the secret, she went back and did her background research. She dug out articles. She called people. She read news articles. She read magazines. She read books. And that's the little part of, you know, the books piling up next to the bed, you know, until you can't get out of bed except for this little path. That's the part she says, oh, yes, you know. So the trick is not to just run out and shoot. You may have an idea. You may shoot early to get an idea of you know, the dynamics or the limits of what you're going to make a documentary about. Mm-hmm. But it's doing the background research. And so that's why we also have a chapter about background research in there.
Absolutely. You cover all bases in this book. Let me tell you, it's very thorough. Another thing that interests me particularly is the interview process. We spoke to the director of a documentary called Jonestown, and I remember vividly asking him, because it was a very painful testimony from all of these participants that interviewed for the film. As a filmmaker, the man behind that camera, it must be a real challenge to keep from interfering and trying to console during those moments and stay objective.
It is. And again, I'm really thinking about how to respond to that, because what we tell people in the book is that the trick is, when you go in, and again, going into the interview is going in without expectations.
Right.
And you go in and you know basically what topic you want to talk about. And then the trick is to, and what we, again, we talked about this, and what Dorothy does is when she talks to somebody, and I asked her just that question, actually, and she says, well, what the person said is going to raise issues for you, they're going to raise emotions for you, you're going to want to get involved. She said the best thing to do is just to admit it. I mean, sometimes, obviously, you can't admit it if you're doing an expose and you disagree violently with somebody. But just to say something along the lines of, you know, that really raises strong emotions for me. Or can you go on a little bit more about that? Or it's hard for me to hear that, and I know it's hard for you to talk about it. But she's transparent about the fact that if she is affected deeply by something, she doesn't sit there and try and shut it down and turn it off. And so the key to the interview process, I think, which I'm very interested to hear your comment on this too. But the key to the interview process is really establishing that contact and essentially turning it into a conversation.
Yeah. I would think so. That was another part of it, I would think to allow for those genuine moments to occur, there has to be a period of just of trying to make them comfortable and forget about the camera. I mean, they can't be self-aware. Is that usually a difficulty? Is that usually a process to get to that point with an interview subject that you must go through?
Absolutely. And I think it comes about because of the contact between the filmmaker and the person being interviewed. If you're a single, and I spend a lot of time talking about this because it's something that I do. If you're a single, you know, a one-man band, and you've got the camera and you're standing there with this little camera, you've got to hold it down so you can look over the LCD, and you've got to have it framed, and you've got to have it wide enough so that you're getting the person in this thing. And then you've got to establish some sort of communication. But I think that largely that contact, that's a tricky subject. Albert Maysl said that he could establish contact with somebody in a glance. And I think it's true, or he, not contact, but what he called it was access, in which somebody would just reveal the most intimate details of their lives and give you these great interviews. And there is something in that eye contact. Certain people have it. Some people can do it instantly. Other people, I can't do it instantly. It takes weeks, days. It can take months before you build up the trust where somebody's going to give you access and let you into their life. And
yeah.
There's a number of ways that happens. And they see you, they get to know you. Then there's the thing also we talk about in the book is the gatekeeper, whether it's a woman who lives down the street and everybody knows her, and she said, look, you can talk to this guy because he's okay, or it's a secretary who's guarding a doctor's calls and screening people out and saying, no, we're not giving interviews about spinal injuries right now. And so what I learned through all this process, it's true for all interviewing, is that it's true that the gaining of trust or trust building or gaining access is just huge.
Sure.
And some people can do it almost instantly. Other people, you just have to work at it.
Well, it brings up a couple of qualities that, you know, you reiterate in your book time and time again that you must have, especially as a documentary filmmaker, but it really applies to any film form, and that's passion and perseverance. And especially in the topic of getting your film finished, I mean, just finishing it, just crossing that finish line is such a challenge, and you dedicate a whole chapter there to finishing the film. Do you find that a lot of people run out of steam, you know, right before they
absolutely
get the finished
film? absolutely when Dorothy Gibbs, I've noticed it talking to filmmakers, but I hadn't really talked to enough filmmakers to see a pattern of it. And I mentioned it one night when we were actually sitting over coffee, and I mentioned this business of finishing a film, because I personally had trouble finishing films. I think at the time I started working with Dorothy, I had two or three unfinished projects, and they were just hanging around my neck like this millstone or something.
Right.
That led to putting the whole chapter in about finishing, because she said when she runs the Producing with Passion workshop, she will ask people, how many people here have an unfinished film? And she said like 80% of the hands will go up. And I suddenly realized that was true for everybody I talked to. They have an unfinished film that's hanging around, that's dogging them. I know I certainly did. And nobody wants to talk about it. You know, everybody's embarrassed to talk about it. Either you've taken money from somebody to finish the film and you haven't finished it. Your family is asking you, you know, you've been working on this a year. Are you ready to show it yet? You made a commitment to deliver it to a festival or somehow, and you've got to step up and say, well, gosh, no, it's not finished. And at some level, you know that it should be finished. And so this is a huge problem. So we actually talked about that in the book. And essentially how to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very enlightening chapter. And another part of your book, too, and we're going backtracking just a little bit,
Oh, sure.
But in terms of putting the film together, are there more and more venues to find funding nowadays for documentary films? I know you have a chapter about funding.
Yeah, there are. I was actually reluctant to put that chapter in because we went back and forth on that. I was reluctant to put it in, but then I started saying, "Well, exactly, you know, how do you fund your films?" Because I hate to ask people for money, and if I accept
right.
money, I feel such a sense of obligation that it's you know, anyway. But
I know I know exactly. You know, it's the creative. The creative instinct is usually at odds with the, you know, the salesman personality that you have to wear.
Exactly.
You have to wear that. Yeah, I understand.
Exactly. And so what I couldn't figure out, I know, even though Dorothy makes her films for almost nothing, and I talked to a few other filmmakers, documentary filmmakers about this, people who got films done and they did it for very little money. But what I found out was that there was something else that she does. And I keep going back to what she does because that's really what the interview is about. I have thoughts about it on other venues, but I'd rather focus on this. But what I realized that what she does is she actually builds a community from the very beginning. She goes out when she shoots that. If she goes out and shoots footage, for example, and she's not quite sure of what the idea is, she'll shoot the footage, and then she'll call together a few people that she really trusts, and she calls those her core group. And we talk about this in the book too. She calls those people her core group, and those are the people who are going to help her really get through the whole process of getting the film done. They're going to be there from the beginning to the end of the film, from the day she has the first idea until the night when they're screening it. And the core group, she doesn't really ask for money. That's actually one of the rules, is that we won't ask for money. But then when they go out to the next level, she extends out to people that the core group knows and people that she meets. And we'll say if the core group is 5 or 6 people, the next meeting may be 14 to 30 people. And these people are called together from a filmmaking community usually, or from a community, if it's a movie about, what's a good topic? Doesn't matter what topic it is, but let's say, here's one. She made a movie recently about a woman named Molly Hale, who was in a car accident and was paralyzed and basically was told she wasn't going to walk again and she wouldn't be able to move her hands. So she made a remarkable recovery because of her the people that helped her and some exercises that she developed. But you would go out to the community that deals with paraplegics, or you, in this instance, and you would contact organizations and say, we're thinking about doing a film about this person, and we're going to cover this topic. Would you like to come and watch some of the footage and talk about it? So those folks show up from the community itself. And so now you have like 15 people, and that's when you start to just put it out there and say, can I contact you later? And talk about fundraising. And now you're going to start getting donations coming in, and they're very small donations. And then that leads to a larger group of people and more donations. And eventually what happens is that this seems to kind of catch fire, and often what will happen is a big donor will step in sometime.
Right.
But it's almost like you have to go in and build that community and get this thing rolling. And what Dorothy says, she's got this great phrase. She said that she's had this happen so often, she realized, she says that the universe has what she calls the universal grant matching service, that if you take you go halfway there and the universe will show up with the rest of the help, but it won't show up until you make that first step.
Right, right. Yeah, that's beautifully put. Yeah. And in terms of when you start your project, what would you recommend as a bare bones crew? What can't you do without?
This will lead to some arm waving arguments with my friends. I have one friend who wouldn't go out without 5 or 6 people. I have another friend that won't go out without more than one person, and another friend who has to go out and do everything himself. But I believe that the minimum crew is at least a cameraman and that maybe a cameraman is going to be responsible for the lighting, the director, and I have very recently come to believe that there really should be a sound person there too. And so I would say three people, because I'm just becoming, I'm working on another book right now called Digital Video Secrets, and it's about how people can take these new HD cameras and actually come out with a product that's good enough to get into film festivals, or can be a, you know, a wonderful movie of their child growing up. But it's good quality. And the thing that I keep coming back to is sound.
Yeah.
And so I'm coming to believe that it's I would want a sound person, camera / lighting person, and the director is an absolute minimum. And then the director also ends up being carrying chairs and moving things.
That's very wise, because people, it's often said that people will forgive a less than stellar image as long as they can hear it, but they won't forgive bad sound. You know, there's
yes.
Yeah, I hear that more and more. And that's another thing that we didn't discuss with it being a revolutionary time for documentaries. If anything, it has to do with this technology that has allowed, you know, every person on the block to you know, partake in this kind of filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the subject of your next book.
Well, I think of this one as the software, and the next one as the hardware.
Okay.
And I'm hoping the publisher agrees with me, and it's already up on Amazon for pre-orders. But I'm hoping that he comes back to me in a year and says, "Gosh, we'd really like you to do the next version of that."
Well,
but,
I hope you will.
Because
this is a fantastic book publisher, and we've interviewed so many of their authors, and they're all stellar talents. And this is a fantastic book, and it's such a great addition to their catalog. And actually, our listeners, if they see their home page there on the Blog Talk Radio page, you'll see the cover of Producing with Passion. If you click on it, it'll take you directly to Amazon, where you can order the book right now. No waiting involved. Just click right there. And Mr. Lavelle, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We appreciate your time.
It's been a great honor to talk to you. Thank
you
very much. I've been listening to your interviews, and I'm just blown away. They're great. They're great.
Keep up the good work.
Keep up the good work.
It's great to have a fan. Thank
yeah.
you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye, sir. Bye-bye. That is Tony Lavelle, Producing with Passion, making films that change the world. Great book. Really inspired me. I like that mandate. You know, make films that change the world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I wish there were more people that thought that way, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, here we go.
All right, ready for Chris Carter.
Okay, there's just one thing I have to do, and it's
okay.
to reboot the switchboard, and that file should be there. So let's keep your fingers crossed. I'm rebooting the switchboard, and drum roll, please, it is there.
Okay, good, okay.
Okay, like we said before, this interview with Chris Carter occurred over like a 15 to 8-minute time span here. He was on his car phone on the LA freeway. So if you hear any interference, that's the sound you hear. But we're thankful for any time we could get with him. So here at long last, ladies and gentlemen, is our interview with Chris Carter, creator of The X-Files and director of the upcoming film, I Want to Believe. Here it goes, guys. Our first guest tonight, Chris Carter, is the spectacularly talented screenwriter, producer, and director behind The X-Files, one of the most popular and acclaimed television shows in the history of the medium. Now, after a refrain of 10 long years, fans across the globe are reveling in the release of the second feature film based on this series, as The X-Files, I Want to Believe, hits movie screens on July 25th.
I called you in because I valued your belief in this phenomenon. I'm not the most popular girl at the FBI right now.
Scully?
Mulder?
It is an honor to welcome this great artist to Movie Geeks United, Mr. Chris Carter. Mr. Carter, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Good, good. Welcome to Movie Geeks United. It's an honor to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's been 10 long years since the first feature film for X-Files. Did you have any doubt that you'd come to this point with your second film?
I had all kinds of doubts. We had talked about doing a movie even during the TV series, and then We talked about it just after the TV series, and for a variety of reasons, it looked like it wasn't going to happen. And then all of a sudden, Fox called up and they said, let's do this. It's now or never. And so we said, let's do it now. And that was last year. And we have a movie coming out on July 25th.
Yeah, but over that period of time, how many lives did this project have? How many drafts did you go through before settling on this one?
Well, we actually, Frank Spotnitz and I actually sat down and worked out a story about 4 years ago, and we pitched it. They had come to us and said, "Let's do a movie." Then, and we pitched it to Fox. They loved the idea. We began negotiations, and then there was a big business problem, like a contractual thing that had to do with the TV show, and it got in the way for several years. So we actually never wrote a script until we finished the script last August, so a year ago coming up, and that was the first time we had actually done a draft of the movie. We did several polishes, I'd call it, on that, and that is really what we shot.
Well, you've decided to, as you've said, to move away from the show mythology, and it's just kind of a standalone premise just for this film alone. Was that always in the back of your mind that you wanted to go that way, and what went behind that decision?
Yeah, we always talked about doing a standalone episode, which really is the kind of, I would call it, meat and potatoes of the X-Files TV series. We had already done a mythology movie, which was sort of, I would call it, a command performance because it was during the ongoing television series, and it was the story to tell then. We feel this is the story to tell now.
Right. Now, I know that the plot is very secretive. People have been told that they can ask anything except the particulars about the plot, so that's very challenging.
That doesn't stop them from asking.
Yeah, I can imagine. I'll try to respect that mandate as much as I can. But how important was kind of crafting the Mulder and Scully characters this time in terms of how they've matured in the interim for these past 10 years?
It's a good question, and it really is the heart of it's the heart of the show and the heart of the movie, and it was very important that we be honest to the characters through the 6 years it's been since we've last seen them. We wanted to imagine where they were in their lives, in their relationship, both personal and professional, and that's really that was the beginning of the conversation about what kind of story to make this.
Mulder?
What?
Stop.
Okay, just feel free to give up like everybody else.
This is not my job anymore, Mulder.
No, that's right. You're just like my booking agent now, right?
You're right. This is my fault.
What do you mean it's your fault?
For getting you involved in this.
No, no. It was the right thing to do, Scully.
This is not about finding an FBI agent. This is about you trying to save your sister.
Sister is dead.
It hasn't stopped you from looking for her. Mulder, I have been through this too many years with you, believing you can save her. You cannot save her, not now and not ever.
Now, when I announced that you were coming on the show, I had so many questions submitted from all around the world, and I wanted to read some of those to you and ask some of these. You've been known to go through chat rooms and message boards during the series to get a sense of what the fans want. Did you do that this time around for the second film?
Frank Spotnitz really keeps tabs on the internet. I'm less so, but he keeps me informed. We're always mindful of the fans to the extent that we can be. But we really just try to tell everybody the best story possible, but we listen, and I have to say it's the fans who got this movie made, in the sense that we heard their voices and responded to their enthusiasm.
Yeah, the fans are fantastic. I mean, I've just these past couple of days, just the correspondence I've had, and really, I mean, from all over the world, they're just dying to see the second film. Scott from Fresno wanted to know if your film will address where the series ended off, for example, with Mulder being tried for murder.
Yes, we take that into account, of course, because that's the last time we saw them. They essentially rode off into the sunset, and with Mulder as a fugitive, Scully, in a sense, as well. But it really is Mulder that is and was wanted by the FBI.
Right, right. And the X-Files Italian fan club, they would like to know the kind of the emotions that you felt when you were on the set that first day after this long interim of 10 years. How did that feel that first day?
It was... The emotion hit me previous to that first day. It hit me when I first sat at my dining room table with David and Jillian doing a table read of the script. And it's the first time all of us had been in the same room together in over 5 years. And I have to say, I got quite emotional. And actually, just even thinking about it right now makes me emotional. It was, we worked and known each other now for, nearly a quarter of our lives. And it's, I think, you know, for Dave and Jillian, that's certainly a quarter of their lives. It was like a family reunion of sorts. It was, I don't know, we have a connection that it's almost indescribable. We all kind of grew up together.
You know, you would have to feel like family. I mean, you spent that much time with this tight-knit group of people, I can imagine. But when you get everyone back together, is there a difference in chemistry between a film set and a TV set?
No, this is a misconception. You really make a movie with the same personnel and equipment as you do a television series. You may have some more toys. You may have some extra personnel for a variety of things, physical effects, visual effects, computer-generated effects, things like that. But essentially, the same cameras. You may change film stock. There is, but of course, you have to be mindful that you are telling a story that is going to be on a gigantic screen. And when you do a close-up, someone's head is going to be 8 to 12 feet tall.
Sure.
All the detail that shows up on that big screen needs to be thought about in a way you can do less so on television. It's a different format. The shape of the screen is different. It is a different storytelling vehicle as well. The big screen demands a certain kind and size of story.
Yeah, but at the same time, do you find that there are things that you can do with the characters and the story on film that you couldn't do on TV?
Well, I'll have to say you must, I think, because the big screen demands a story to match. And that's not to say it needs to be a spectacle or it needs to be, an epic. But for what we do, we needed to put the characters in a situation and or place, take them someplace we wouldn't do in the television series, really, because we were telling 20 to 25 stories a year, and we couldn't. You can only take the characters emotionally so far through those, both the year, you know, the season, and the season of the X-Files. We would wear them out and the audience out if we took them too far, too fast.
Right, right. Just got a couple more questions for you. I know you're on the road and you're very busy, but I'll let you off the hook in just one second. But David from Scotland wanted to know, why the intense secrecy?
The element of surprise is something that filmmakers used to hold sort of naturally, and it was fun to go to a movie and not know what you were going to see. Now there's a called the business of spoiling the secret.
Sure.
Everyone if the word leaks out, everyone knows instantly around the world, and there are these sites dedicated to spoiling the secret. When we did the first movie, I think one of the first days of filming, and the entire plot was in the National Enquirer. you know, it's just, you know, everyone tries to keep a secret. We, so far, we've kept a secret. I don't know if we can keep it for the next month, but we'd like to. And it seems to me that the fans would like to have it a secret as well. It'd be more fun to open that present on Christmas Day, so to speak. And
yeah.
And journalists have been very respectful of it as well.
Speaking of secrecy, it was released on the news last week that you're already in the midst of filming your next project.
You know, I put something on film that was important to me, something I wanted to say. I'm going to work on it slowly. I don't know if it'll ever come out, but it's just something that I felt I wanted to try.
Yeah. Would you consider this your dream project?
Not necessarily, but it seemed to be something that was important to me, and I'm working on it.
Okay. We have a question from Buenos Aires. It asks, there's a common thread of philosophy, faith, and psychology that runs through your work. What does that say about you and your views on humanity, and where does this come from?
It probably comes from my parents and my upbringing and my own faith, which has grown and continues to be tested. And these are the important questions in life. And I'm so blessed, as has been everyone who has worked for and written on The X-Files, to be able to sort of talk about these things through the characters for so long.
Yeah, yeah. And that ceasefire strategies, that was a question from her as well. It seemed to be a very common question out there for you. If this is successful, and I know it will we be looking for another X-Files film in the future?
I'm knocking wood right now, because it is successful. And I think, naturally, I think there would be a desire to see another movie if this movie is successful. But right now, we're hard at work at trying to make sure that this one, in fact, does well.
Well, I wish you the best of luck with it, sir, and I appreciate the time you've taken out for us today.
Thank you. I hope you're right, and I appreciate all the enthusiasm.
Thank you so much, Mr. Carter.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye now. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye.
So you believe in these kind of things?
Let's just say I want to believe.
All right, there's your 15 minutes with Chris Carter.
That was awesome. Congratulations.
So, thank you. So what did we learn? We learned that, yes, it's a standalone film, but it won't leave the fans of the series cold. There'll be some morsels for you guys to devour in there. And you don't necessarily have to be an X-Files fan to enjoy the film on its own as well.
I think that's a good point. I think that's something really smart on his part and on their part to do, because it has been 6 years, and I think that's smart to do. Especially if you want people to go back and watch the show, I think it's wonderful.
Right. And then also of note, the movie that he's been secretly making, I got the feeling that, you know, this isn't even something that he's in his mind yet he's even thinking about distributing. It's just something he feels a passionate whim about doing, and we'll see where it ends up. I think that's where his mind is.
Yeah, I was surprised by his reaction to that question.
Yeah, I take it as not a studio kind of backed project. It's just something he's and taking on his own. That's the feeling I get from it. But thank you all out there for being so patient with us tonight. We're glad we finally got this out there to you.
Yes.
You can subscribe to our show via iTunes for free. Any episode will automatically come up as soon as it's archived for replay. And you can get our past episodes that way as well. We air every Sunday night at 6 p.m. Eastern, Wednesday night at 10 p.m. Eastern. Got some great special shows upcoming, including the first of a 3-part tribute to Steven Spielberg later on in the month. And if you check out our tribute shows, you'll know that that's the Movie Geeks United bread and butter right there.
this is going to be big. I'm going to get eaten by a shark on the – we're going to videotape that and put that on a blog somewhere.
And who doesn't want
to
see that? Who doesn't want to see that?
I think everyone in their right mind will turn in to see that.
So we're sorry that we got hooked up a little tonight in the beginning, but thank you all for being so loyal to us, and we will see you back here Sunday at 6.
Happy 4th of July, everyone.
Thank you, guys. Yeah, happy holidays. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Are you a filmmaker looking for a great score for your next movie? Well, look no further than Michael McCormick, the composer whose works you hear at the opening and the closing of every episode of Movie Geeks United. This is a phenomenal talent, and you can hear more samples of his work at michaelmccormickmusic.com or on his MySpace page, which you can access through the Movie Geeks United Top Friends.